Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A couple of days ago, I called Dana Goodyear, who's been reporting from California on the wildfires. Dana, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Now, it has to be said, you, among many, many other families around the Los Angeles area, had to be evacuated. Had you ever been evacuated before, and what's that like?
I had not. So I've been in California since 2005 and have, as you know, often written about fires. And to do that, I go out trying to find fires and people who have been evacuated.
Yeah.
And it was weirdly convenient that the story came right to my door. It wasn't harrowing from a kind of, you know, ash falling from the sky and flames licking at the houses point of view for me and my family. It was just more, I was so surprised that the concern, and I think the reason that the evacuations were so aggressive this year was that the wind was blowing very, very powerfully and in a direction that put a whole bunch of neighborhoods in the potential path of the fire.
So this is the new normal for so many people in California, Northern California, Southern California, and other parts of the country. How does that change your psychology going forward?
Well, I loved it last year when Jerry Brown called it the new abnormal. It's just perfectly well put. But it has always been normal here to have seasonal fire. That is the ecology of California. What's abnormal is to have so much residential development up into the mountain areas. Housing has pushed into those territories where fires used to burn freely and not bother anybody. But there's also, obviously, the huge factor of the warming climate. The brush is very dry, and the winds are blowing very, very intensely. So that has created the possibility not of, you know, major conflagrations separated by 15 years in which people can recover and forget, but every year. And that's what felt really different about this fall was in Southern California, the Woolsey Fire, which killed three people, was very devastating. And to have another fire a year later that had the potential to do that much damage or more, I think that was a bit of a shift in the psychology for me and for lots of people I talked to, where the idea that this could happen every year or could happen again next month also and the month after that, because fire season is getting longer and longer. And I think that's hard to cope with and hard to figure out, you know.
Well, but it's also caused a lot of stories about whether ultimately California is habitable. In other words, we're hearing a lot of kind of catastrophe writing.
I know, because it's fun. It's fun.
Well, is it legitimate?
Well, I think California will be habitable for a very, very long time. I don't think it's as dire as all that in terms of how people will respond to it. You know, will we have a reverse Dust Bowl? No, I don't think we will. But, you know, I think that it has caused people to question some of the tenets of the California dream. And
how do you mean?
Well, you know, California is a place that is supposed to represent a kind of an ideal expression of natural beauty and creative possibility, and people are, you know, they're health fanatics here, and everything is supposed to be about this sort of glorious, shiny expression of being your best possible self. And the illusion that this place was a refuge from every, you know, problem and struggle, which I think some people actually believe, even if they don't really live it out, I think that is gone, but that was silly and unrealistic anyway.
Do you ever think about leaving California?
Look, if every year there was a catastrophic event that caused me to fear for my children's lives, I might think about going somewhere else. But I also think that this is a place where people really do innovate. And you know, if these climate problems were not coming home to roost in California, some of the potential for the solution wouldn't be here. I mean, there's an urgent need for solutions to how we're going to live in the future, all of us, not just Californians. And I do have, I hope not misplaced confidence in the brains that are here and the people who are working in the sciences in particular who, you know, I have heard of new soils that are being developed that are flame resistant. And the way people are planting now is much, much more sensitive to the issues of climate. And the water conservation lessons that we got from that extended drought, those are lasting. So there is a way in which I see a lot of the problems originating here and being manufactured here and also a lot of the solutions.
Dana Goodyear, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Dana Goodyear, a staff writer at the magazine, and you can read her coverage of the California fires at NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. For 10 years, Congress debated the DREAM Act. It gave a pathway to citizenship to undocumented immigrants who had come here as children. There were possibly millions of such people. It was introduced at first with bipartisan support. But immigration hardliners kept throwing up hurdle after hurdle, and a decade later, the DREAM Act had gone nowhere. Finally, President Obama just gave up. Instead, in 2012, he issued the executive policy we know as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. If the Dreamers couldn't become citizens, he could at least shield them from deportation. After the Trump administration abruptly canceled DACA, a number of plaintiffs sued, and their case goes to the Supreme Court this week, on Tuesday. The New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer recently spoke with two of the lawyers who are going to argue the case.
I first met Luis Cortez in February of 2017 because I was writing a story about a DACA recipient, and I needed to get in touch with that person's lawyer. Luis was his lawyer. And so I call up Luis with a long list of questions, and he expertly walks me through the ins and outs of this person's case. And we get to talking, and in the course of the conversation, it starts to come out that Luis himself is a DACA recipient. And so his own fate is bound up in the fates of all of the clients he's representing who also have DACA. Luis was born in Morelia, Michoacán, in Mexico, and came to the U.S. with his parents when he was barely a year old. He had no sense growing up that he didn't have legal status. He didn't understand really what that meant, what the limitations would eventually be on him, on his family. And that's a fairly common experience.
The first time I think I really realized what being undocumented meant was when I was in eighth grade. And there was a trip to Europe that the eighth grade class was taking. And in order to offset some of the costs, we were going to sell See's Candies chocolate in order to fundraise. And I sold a ton of chocolate. I was hustling that chocolate hardcore. And I had raised enough money to go. And it wasn't until after where I let my parents know, I made it and I have all this money, and that they let me know, you can't go. Because you weren't born here. And that's all I knew at that time. I couldn't go because I wasn't born here. But I didn't really know much more of the mechanics in eighth grade. I remember being very pissed that I wasn't able to go.
And you know, you go to college. From college, you go straight to law school. So when you started in law school, it was 2010. DACA wasn't a thought on anyone's mind yet as such. And so there were questions, too, about what your working life would look like even after law school, right? Because you didn't have necessarily a legal avenue to be employable.
That's right.
At that time. Mm-hmm. So what was your sense of what DACA was? Did it immediately seem like a lifeline to you? Was it something you were suspicious of?
Mm-hmm.
How did you understand it?
Yeah. So it was, I had just finished my second year of law school, and it was during the summer. So I was going into my last year, and then DACA is announced as I'm about to start my last year of law school. And it almost seemed too good to be true. It seemed like it fell from the sky.
Now, let's be clear. This is not amnesty. This is not immunity. This is not a path to citizenship. It's not a permanent fix. This is a temporary stopgap measure that lets us focus our resources wisely while giving a degree of relief and hope to talented, driven, patriotic young people. It is the right thing to do.
I decided to apply, and in a very nervous way, I submitted my application. The scariest part was going into the DHS offices to get fingerprinted, mm-hmm. because those DHS offices are the same offices that ICE is located. So you have this sense of like, what if I get fingerprinted and I don't come out?
Right.
And but I remember when my work permit came in and I got my Social Security number, it was life-changing.
Yeah. And so you go on, thanks in large part to having this lawful status conferred through DACA, you go on to practice immigration law.
Yeah.
You're living your life. You have your clients. You're working in Seattle.
Yeah.
And then 2016 happens. And President Trump takes office. And not entirely out of the blue, because there had been murmurings of this, but still somewhat suddenly, the administration comes out and cancels DACA just outright.
Good morning. I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
DACA program was implemented. What do you do then? I mean, you're also, as an immigration lawyer, you're responding to this state of chaos now. And as a DACA recipient, you're responding to this state of chaos. Mm-hmm. What was your immediate reaction and what were your first moves in the immediate aftermath after September 5th, 2017, when the administration canceled DACA?
Yeah. You know, my reaction was both out of frustration and disappointment. And part of my frustration was that this is the fear realized by hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients when they first applied. You know, what happens if they do away with this program and then start and, you know, now they have all of our information.
And this is 700,000 people.
Yes. Yeah. Hundreds of thousands of people and their communities and, you know, their employers, their spouses, their children. We're talking about millions of people now. And so it was a very confusing and kind of chaotic time. We were flooded with phone calls that day, that week, about whether DACA is done away with altogether, what now. And interestingly enough, you know, as we're having this conversation, I'm almost having this conversation with myself, too, about, you know, if DACA does end, what then? And I'm, as explaining it to them, I'm hearing myself saying it out loud, me realizing, like, what then?
And what were you saying? What were you hearing yourself say?
That there really isn't any other way. That there is no other way to get status. And that we're going to be back to what we were before. Hiding.
The administration's decision to cancel DACA is now coming before the Supreme Court. And it's coming before the Supreme Court because a number of different groups in a number of different venues challenged the legality of how the administration ended DACA in the first place. And on November 12th, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in this case. And you are going to be one of, is it three people?
Four.
Four people sitting at the plaintiff's table in front of the justices. Who else is going to be at the table?
Right. There was a lot of discussions about who would represent this case. And representing the individual DACA recipients is going to be myself and Ted Olson, who was formerly the Solicitor General under George W. Bush.
And so Ted Olson's not someone just on its face who would be aligned with this cause. I mean, a sort of legendary conservative Supreme Court litigator.
You know, Ted is a very skilled Supreme Court litigator, and knows the you know, the pace of the arguments and how to. There's a special art and a science to argue the Supreme Court. So you know, we feel very lucky to have someone like Ted around.
Hello,
hi, Mr. Olson.
Yes.
How are you? This is Jonathan Blitzer from The New Yorker. Thanks for making the time.
We're happy to do it.
Could you talk a bit about what you see as the central issue of this case?
It all boils down to whether or not the termination of DACA was legal, whether what the reasons for doing so are and what the consequences are. When the government of the United States announces a policy that has an immediate impact on very substantial numbers of persons, in this case 700,000 persons and their families, persons who have been authorized to work pursuant to the program, travel, receive certain benefits, and things of that nature, the impact on those individuals requires the government to announce reasons for its decision, to explain what it has considered in making that decision, explaining why that decision is lawful, so that there will be accountability for those decisions. And this administration, announcing the rescission of this program, gave no reasons for the decision and no explanation for it.
You know, there's this phrase under the Administrative Procedures Act called arbitrary and capricious. An agency can't act arbitrarily or capriciously. And one of the ways that it does that is it goes through the rationale and it goes through the consequences of all of a sudden sharply changing a policy. And again, it could consider everything and say, yeah, it's worth it. Fine. That's fine. As long as it does its homework. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of considerations that were made here.
How common is it that the government gets called out along these lines? It seems to me anyway, that before the Trump administration, as a journalist, I wasn't concerning myself with the Administrative Procedures Act with all that much regularity, but now I am.
Well, yes. The answer to that question is that the government frequently gets caught up by the judiciary for insufficiently explaining why it is doing something, or explaining it in a way that is obviously transparently not correct. They had the same problem, the Trump administration had the same problem with the addition of the citizenship question on the census, and the Supreme Court decided, well, you might be able to add that question, but you've got to be able to explain it, and you can't give us bogus reasons for doing so.
And in terms of your specific strategy now coming before the justices, are there particular justices on the court you're targeting your arguments to? How are you thinking about the composition of the court, and how does that impact the way in which you frame your case?
Well, what we do is that we attempt to convince all of them. Mm-hmm. We're not sanguine about how any justice will vote on a particular issue in a particular case or anything like that. But we want to make arguments that are focused on the way the justices have decided cases in the past. And in this area, where all we're asking is for the court to recognize that this administration, and by the way, not for the first time, this administration has acted in an arbitrary fashion, ready, fire, aim. Mm-hmm. And we want the justices, whichever end of the political spectrum their backgrounds might be, to understand that this is a rule of law case. It isn't a liberal or conservative case. It's a rule of law case, but it's a rule of law case involving hundreds of thousands of individuals who will be hurt by an abrupt and unexplained and unjustified change in policy. This puts the human face on this is very, very real to all of these individuals who are going to school, raising families, serving in our armed forces, forming businesses, becoming a part of the community, and then having to live with this sword of Damocles hanging over them all of the time and the uncertainty that that causes. You can imagine how difficult it would be to live a life in the shadow of that doom, so to speak. This is a very, very serious thing.
Luis, you're going to be one of the few people in the courtroom, but certainly the only person sitting at one of the litigators' tables before the justices, whose personal life is at stake, given what the arguments are and how these arguments play out. What does that feel like? Does it feel like a burden? Does it feel like an opportunity? Does it make you nervous? Does it make you, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, it kind of depends what hat I'm wearing. You know, as a lawyer, I am very stoked about it. I didn't think that I would have a Supreme Court case this early on in my career. And so I'm very excited to be not just in the court, but at the litigator's table. It's also very daunting. The nine people who are going to be hearing the case and who I'll be looking at them and they'll be looking at me is, you know, they're going to have a tremendous impact on my life. And they're the ones who get to decide whether my clients are deported and me with them.
Do you have faith in those nine faces you'll be staring at?
I have to. You know, one of the things that I have learned as a lawyer is that, and what makes, I think, the U.S. significantly different from any other country, it's its court system and its ability to do the right thing, the just thing, when there's injustice done. And this, although it's imperfect, this country has an amazing history of doing that.
Jonathan Blitzer spoke with Luis Cortez and Ted Olson, who are both arguing against the Trump administration in the Supreme Court this week. The Department of Justice had no comment for our story. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Eliza Griswold writes for the New Yorker about a lot of things, but especially about the intersection of faith and politics. Now, Eliza, you've been talking to a guy named Doug Padgett, who's a pastor. Who is he, and why did you want to talk to him?
Doug Padgett is a progressive evangelical, and he is really running an effort to bring religious voters into the Democratic Party. He is explicitly helping to move people away from Trump, but also Republicanism in general, saying, listen, this isn't our history, and you guys have been used for a long time, so let's return to what the core really looks like.
Well, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, if we do look really back to the 70s, I mean, he often likes to say that, you know, when we're looking at the 70s, we're looking at the most famous American white evangelical is Jimmy Carter, a progressive. So we've lost that identity over the past 40 years, and he's trying to really get us back to what the breadth of evangelical really means.
The Bible and the teachings of Jesus are about inclusion, and they're about love, and they're about the God of all, and that there's children from many other families, and all of these narratives that are in the Bible, they really lean to a much more progressive understanding, as we would frame it, you know, sort of the left and the right these days. And that's part of the reason that the religious right has had to work so hard, and part of the reason they work so aggressively to not allow any space between their conservatism and their evangelicalism, because if they let any air in there, it's just going to start to break apart.
In a way, what you're doing is reclaiming Jesus from the Christian right and saying Jesus was a radical. This is what he said. This is what how he lived. And we are going to live and work according to those teachings.
Yeah, very much. I'm a little nervous just in my own temperament about reclaiming language, because it feels like then one side has it or the other side has it, like a football analogy. Now we are on offense and we have the ball and you have to stop us, and then you have the ball and we have to stop you. I'm not sure that's the best way to frame this conversation. Conservative Christians, they want to stand with Jesus. And so do progressive Christians. And this is the good news of all this. It means we have to stand with each other as well. So the question then becomes not only how do we talk to ourselves about this Jesus, but how do we talk to each other?
Okay, so if we're not talking about some dualistic notion of reclaiming language, we certainly are talking about reclaiming voters, right?
Yeah.
So tell us, what are you up to with Vote Common Good? Do you think these voters actually exist, and how can you prove it?
Yeah, there are so what we're doing with Vote Common Good is we are going to try to influence the national narrative around the role of religion in politics so that voters who feel that they're religiously motivated and could never vote for a Democrat see that that's a possibility. We think there's three kinds of voters that they can go after. They can go after those who voted for Democrats in the past and were lost in the last 10 or 12 years.
Obama, right?
Significant number, yeah. Had Hillary Clinton, you know, gotten half of the support that Barack Obama did, the Electoral College wouldn't have been a loss for her. And then we have these newly enraged voters, people who have just woken up and they're furious because the Trump administration and the Republican complicity with the Trump administration is just so far from common decency or what we would call the common good. And then there's a group of people who've sat it out. They don't vote. It doesn't matter to them. And this set of conditions could bring them in. And we have a number of campaigns that we're using to invite people who haven't voted before.
See, I know to you that you hear that these people exist, but I don't think the most of us do, right? And I myself doubted you and then recently have been meeting some people who are living within conservative families who don't hold their family's political views anymore, who say they may be willing to risk that vote. So
I was just at a large national conference of the extreme right called the Values Voters Summit. We were there asking for voters there to take our Love in Politics pledge, which is built around 1 Corinthians 13 definition of love, and asking our politicians to comport themselves in their political lives in a way that is loving. Well, we were kicked out of the event.
Yeah, how'd that go for
you?
Yeah,
we were kicked out of the event. But before that, I was hearing different people talk, and I heard a very prominent, religiously motivated former politician, she was saying to someone else, for a lot of us evangelicals, the things Donald Trump is doing, talking about himself as the ultimate wisdom and his lack of support for the Kurds, it's just something that we're finding totally intolerable and we don't know what to do about it. Now, I'm just suggesting that if she's saying that in a safe place around the most committed group of people on these issues, the change is happening. But look, most people don't think about politics, and most people don't think about their religion, and most people don't think about how the two impact each other. So groups like ours, we think, need to exist to be that moment in time when people will think about those two ideas and put them together.
So you are trying to help Democratic candidates learn how to speak more effectively to people of faith.
That's correct.
How are you doing that, and where do you see people doing a good job, and what do they have to do better?
To your question, who's doing it well? Actually, most people. Like, once you give permission to Democratic candidates to say, feel free to talk about religion, it's okay. You don't have to get it right all the time, and you certainly don't have to bluff that somehow you're more religious than you actually are. And secondly, knowing religiously motivated voters, this is what all the advocacy groups do when they feel that they have a constituency that's not well represented. They try to allow the candidate or the candidate staff to meet those people. But so many of these Democratic politicians, their lives have not crossed or intersected with religious people, especially evangelicals or white Catholics in some parts of the country. And that's what part of the problem. They feel nervous. So we introduce them to people. We let them meet with pastors and with leaders. So they're like, hey, I have a friend in that world, and I can feel confident that what I'm about to say, my friend would say that's a legitimate thing to say.
Okay, a few weeks ago in the CNN town hall, Elizabeth Warren was asked how she'd respond to a voter who came up to her with objections to gay marriage on religious grounds.
Let's say you're on the campaign trail and you have been, yes. and a supporter approaches you and says, Senator, I'm old-fashioned and my faith teaches me that marriage is between one man and one woman. What is your response?
Well, I'm going to assume it's a guy who said that. And I'm going to say, then just marry one woman. I'm cool with that. Assuming you can find one.
She got snarky at the end, and as someone who's a big fan of snark, I appreciated it at one level, and my heart just sunk at the other, which is, you know, that's what got the attention in the world that I was in, was, see, this is what they're just mean, these progressives.
They don't respect us.
They don't respect us.
I thought of the first part of that clip because you had said to me, she's actually doing a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain why?
Elizabeth Warren has a way of responding. She gives long answers, and she roots it in as many of the places in her life that have brought her to this conclusion, of which for her, her own personal faith has been something that has really motivated her. So she's comfortable tapping into it. What I have noticed is that if a candidate is good at talking about their history, their upbringing, their influences, then they'll do that well with the Bible and with their church history or with their Jewish faith. Like if I were coaching Elizabeth Warren on that answer when the man said,
yeah,
what do I do here?
Yeah.
Her answer started out pretty good, which was, well, you don't have to, you're not under jeopardy. No one's going to ask you to marry someone you don't want to marry.
Right.
That's good. But I also would have had her add there, it seems that your faith is really important to you. For me, I've come to this not from a faith perspective, but I've come to it from this other perspective. But just acknowledging that it's legitimate,
yeah,
for a person to use their faith to frame the way they think about,
yeah,
it, to say, if your faith drives you to care about these issues, then I want to be the candidate that represents you, even if I don't represent your faith. I don't know why candidates aren't saying that stuff all the time.
Okay, speaking of which, let's talk about Mayor Pete for a minute, because here we have somebody who's fluent in talking about where he comes from and his faith in a way that feels effective to me, but he's gay. Would he ever be able to reach a conservative voter at the edge because of his homosexuality, or no way?
I hope so. If you had asked me in 2014, would evangelicals be able to surround themselves around someone like Donald Trump? There would have been no way. I would not have hedged the way I'm hedging on Mayor Pete right now. I'm not sure if the country's, to the conservatives and the religious conservatives who say, look, things have just moved so fast. And when people are being honest with me, I hear this a lot.
I do too.
They're kind of used to religious people being bad in their marriages, rude, and generally unlikable people. So a religious person's like, oh, I'm used to that. I see Donald Trump. What they're not used to, you know, are these other changes that they think are so new. So I think we have to be empathic to the experience of someone's fast change, but also to say to them, you're going to be okay. like you've a lot of things have changed in your life, you know?
Yeah.
And not allow people this to get out, but also to recognize that it is their experience.
Yeah. So you get pushback not just from conservative religious people. You get pushback from Democrats who don't really want the Democratic Party affiliated with religion, right? What does that sound like, and what do you say to them?
We've actually had more people express their concerns and worry or pushback from the Democratic political side than from the religious side. The pushback is generally the Democratic Party has been one of the places where people for whom faith is not their organizing principle have felt like they have power, like they're included, and they're part of the American expression and experience. We respond by reminding them that that's a really good pushback, first of all, because it's true. We have those same concerns. The pushback to shouldn't we keep a separation between church and state? We say yes. We're not talking about putting Christian values or Jewish teachings into our laws. We're talking about asking voters to vote for these candidates. And when people feel left out, we want to make sure that they understand that religious people don't have to be intolerant or only think about their own self-interests. Like, we don't think you should vote for Christian candidates. We think Christian people should vote for candidates that support the common good. That's what we think they should do rather than their political party commitments. I don't think the current situation where Republicans are religious, Democrats are not religious, is the only future. The American structure is changing, and we have to allow religion and politics to also be part of that structural change.
That's Doug Padgett, a pastor and founder of Vote Common Good. He spoke with The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold. Eliza, what does Doug Padgett have to say about abortion? That's a huge divide, obviously, between the Democrats and religious voters. Is there any way to bridge that?
You know, Doug really grew up inside the pro-life movement. I mean, he wasn't a big activist, but historically he was within that movement. And he thinks that really we're looking at criminalizing abortion. Like, if people want to repeal Roe v. Wade, there's no way to reach them. But Doug believes people are mobilized around, really around Trump's racism and his sexism. And so when Trump speaks the way that he does, he turns off those constituents. And really, Doug thinks that they are numerous enough. Like, do they have to be masses and masses? They could be a couple of percentage points, and that might make the difference.
A couple of percentage points means everything.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Eliza. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As the presidential candidates go around trying to make their cases, one of the stops, almost obligatory at this point, is the syndicated radio program, The Breakfast Club. It didn't start out as a political show. It was a morning show big on hip-hop and sports and celebrity gossip. But that all changed in 2016.
The first candidate I will believe we had, I think it was Bernie. I'm pretty sure it was Bernie Sanders.
One of the hosts of the show is Leonard McKelvey, professionally known as Charlemagne the God.
Why? Because you had Killer Mike and you had Simone Sanders working on his campaign at the time. And Nina Turner was working with him. And they all was like, yo, Bernie, if you're trying to get to black and brown people, you need to go on the Breakfast Club.
This is a good look for you.
Yes.
Too,
so he did it. Then Hillary after him. And this year, every single Democratic candidate damn near has come through.
It was Charlemagne who grilled Elizabeth Warren about how she once identified as Native American. And he compared her to Rachel Dolezal. But he's not only or not primarily a political person. His most recent book is much more personal than that. It's about his experiences in therapy. And he's addressing in particular the stigma of mental health treatment in the black community. Charlemagne the God came to our offices at One World Trade Center recently, and he sat down with a small audience for a conversation with The New Yorker's Natalie Mead.
Before you walked into the room, I sort of gave the crowd some biographical information about you, including the fact that you grew up in Monk's Corner, which is a small town in South Carolina. What was it like to grow up there?
Monk's Corner is like a rural area. The population was like 7,000 people when I was coming up. It's like 10,000 now. I mean, it's a rural area, so like it's really, if I wasn't playing football, which I wasn't, like, so all of my other cousins, all my cousins was playing football, so they had something to do.
Right.
Like, I didn't have anything to do, so, you know, I don't mind, it's the devil's playground. So I ended up, like, hanging in the trap, you know, and that's how I got involved in selling drugs and, you know, a whole bunch of nothing.
I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, being in the trap. And you talk about how you buried something. Tell us about that story.
Oh, that was, man, I had bought what you call a half ounce of crack. And the reason I bought that is because the most money I think I ever made was like $1,100 at one time.
Wow.
Which, you know, back then it seemed like a whole lot of money. And I was dating this young lady at the time, so I thought I was balling. So she came home from college, and I took her and her friend to the mall. And whatever I bought her, I bought her friend.
Wow.
Stupidest thing I could have ever.
Very generous of you.
Stupidest thing I could have ever did in my life. So I think I spent like $700.
Wow.
Like, you know, like, because I wasn't, like, I was buying, like a Bath and Body Works basket and buy her friend one too, like. And I remember I had, like, you know, $400 left, $300, something like that. And I was like, oh, I got to re-up. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I took consignment. So I took a half ounce of, you know, crack. And it was actually not cocaine. It was this substance called isotol,
mm-hmm.
right? That's how they, that was, it was like, so it really wasn't crack.
Right.
It was
right.
Nothing, really. And so I couldn't sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I couldn't sell it, I was like, man, yo, like this just isn't working. So then I buried it because I was hiding it, you know, and then somebody stole it from me.
You said that you were paranoid, like what, you thought the cops were coming, or was that a
different
time?
Well, you know, I didn't realize I was dealing with anxiety and having panic attacks
exactly,
back then.
Yeah.
So I was on probation, and I had stopped smoking weed, which is so crazy to me because when I used to smoke weed, I used to have the worst panic attacks in the world. And then when I got on probation and I stopped smoking weed, I wasn't having these panic attacks mm-hmm. as bad.
Mm-hmm.
So this one day I smoked weed, I had a panic attack. Why I didn't realize the correlation at the time, I have no idea,
mm-hmm.
right? But I buried the dope because I just knew that the police was coming. And when I said I scared everybody,
yeah.
I scared everybody. I was like, yo, the police are coming, the police are coming, the police are coming. So everybody's like, man, let's sit outside, man. This dude bugging, right?
Yeah.
So we all outside. And yes, the police absolutely came.
Damn.
So
damn.
That was one time where my anxiety 100% mm-hmm. helped me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like your instincts were really taking off too.
Yeah, and the weed.
And the weed.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to write a book about your anxiety?
That's a good question. I don't think I necessarily decided to write a book about my anxiety, you know. But I was going to therapy,
right.
you know. And in therapy, I was keeping a journal of everything that I was experiencing. Like, just keeping a journal of my journey in therapy. And I was like, this is the most interesting thing going on in my life right now. And I just happened to tell it to my book publishers. And he was like, that wouldn't be a bad idea, you know. And so there's a guy in my book named Dr. Ish Major.
Yes, let's talk about him.
He's an actual psychiatrist. So when I was keeping this journal and explaining my feelings, Dr. Ish, you know, came in and read that stuff, and he just gave clinical correlations to the stuff that I was explaining I was going through in therapy, and then it became this book.
So when did you first realize that you were dealing with anxiety, like a diagnosable clinical generalized anxiety?
First time I got diagnosed was 2010.
Okay.
I was back home living with my mom. Mm-hmm. I was like 31 years old. I had just gotten fired for the fourth time from radio.
Right.
My daughter was like one or two. My now wife was back living at home with her parents.
Mm-hmm.
and I had just started collecting unemployment for the first time. You know, Biggie Small said being broke at 30 give a brother the chills. So mm-hmm. like being at home with my mom collecting unemployment checks with a daughter, that's not the way I wanted mm-hmm. my life to be. And I remember driving down I-26 in South Carolina on the way to Monk's Corner to Orangeburg. Mm-hmm. And I just had that same feeling that I've had several times throughout my life. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, your palms start sweating, right. your hands start shaking, mm-hmm. your heart starts beating through your chest.
Yeah.
You feel like you're about to have a heart attack, mouth gets dry. Pull over, drink some water. I'm like, try to take a few deep breaths. I'm like, yo, I'm gonna go to the doctor tomorrow. Yeah. Figure this out. In my mind, I'm like, I've been eating too much Chick-fil-A. The sodium is killing me, right? And so I went to the doctor, and the doctor tells me what he always tells me. Yeah. He's like, yo, you got an athlete's heart. You're fine.
Yes,
but that was the first time somebody said to me, do you have anxiety? And I was like, anxiety? I'm like, I don't have anxiety. And he was like, well, it sounds like you had a panic attack. Mm-hmm. And he was like, have you had these symptoms before? And I'm like, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, I think you have panic attacks. And then he was like, are you stressed out about anything? And I'm like, hell yeah. So in my mind, yeah. all I got to do is get me another gig mm-hmm. and everything will be okay. Yeah. And the next gig I got was The Breakfast Club. But, you know, 4 or 5 years later, you know, even though you have success and you got books and TV shows mm-hmm. or whatever it is, like, you know, you're still having those same symptoms, still having those panic attacks. So I said to myself, I'm going to stop flirting with the idea right. of therapy and actually try to go get a handle on it. I just also started to realize that anxiety and like bouts of depression was something that was just kind of common.
Talk about how that was common in your family life. I know you talked about your grandmother when last time you met, and there's a hurricane in Monk's Corner, and you.
Well, you know, I didn't know what that stuff was back then.
Yeah, because you were like 10, 11, right?
Yeah, so I go, so you know, we just used to be like, yo, grandma nerves bad. Mm-hmm. But they really were.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and those pills she used to talk about taking that had to calm her nerves, that yeah. was like, you know, I guess. What Xanax would be now, you know?
Right.
So it's like I didn't realize my grandmother was really dealing with real bad anxiety. Mm-hmm. I just thought she was the most paranoid, pessimistic person alive, mm-hmm. you know? Because she yeah. would be talking to me about these people in the woods that's watching her, and she'd be on the phone sounding like she a drug dealer, like, I can't talk on the phone, you got to come see me, you know? But she was really just suffering from bad anxiety. Yeah. And when you look at her life, like, you know, she was the oldest of, I think, five or six kids, if I'm not mistaken. Six, I believe. The oldest is six, but all her siblings passed away. Her parents passed away. She had an oldest son, you know, who's my uncle. I never met him, but he passed away. So you would understand why her nerves were bad, you know? And then, like, you know, the first time I can remember having a panic attack was when Hurricane Hugo happened, you know, in Charleston, South Carolina. And we was all in this school for shelter. And, like, all the adults around us were panicked. You just heard about the worst things happening. This person's going to lose their house, and this is going to happen, that's going to happen. And so I remember having, like, this sense of insecurity that I never felt before. Because, you know, those are the people around you that's supposed to keep you secure and make you feel secure. So when you see them bugging out, you start bugging out too. So that's the first time I ever actually remember having a panic attack. Even my mom, to a certain extent, my mom went to therapy, you know, more so after her and my father got a divorce. But, you know, she was dealing with her anxiety issues as well.
I want to talk to you a bit more about therapy in Black communities. I know that you really had Black men in mind when writing about this topic.
I mean, because I am a Black man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In case y'all didn't notice. Yeah, I mean, it's just something that we never spoke about.
Yeah.
I don't think that people really understood what people were going through. And I think that a lot of times Black people, we think we're doing ourselves favors by keeping secrets. So even if you are going through something, you don't say nothing about it. Like, you know, my father, Thanksgiving of last year, I had a cousin who killed himself. He was 26 years old. And him and my father used to work together because my father does, like, you know, construction and stuff. So he would have him working some odd jobs with him. And then my father actually read my book, and my father told me that he tried to kill himself like 30 plus years ago. And he was going to therapy 2 and 3 times a week. And he was on 10 to 12 different medications throughout his life. Like, what? And I remember telling my mom that, and I was like, did you know Pops was going through all this? And my mom was like, I thought he was just playing crazy to get a check. So it's like nobody was taking it serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Recently in the news, there were two incidents where two Black people were killed in their homes. Mm. One was Botham Jean, who was shot by an off-duty officer who walked into the wrong apartment. She was recently convicted to 10 years in prison. And then there was Tatiana Jefferson, who was killed by an officer responding to a wellness check. And she was playing video games with her young nephew. So, and you talked about how you feel rage at first, and that could be a symptom of, that is a symptom of PTSD. How do you channel that? And how do you sort of, I guess, process all that's going on in the world when there's so much negativity and so much oppression against our people still to this day?
Man, I don't know if you can channel it to anything positive, because at the end of the day, you're just constantly questioning, you know, what do you have to do to make this stop? I don't have any answers to that. You know, I don't know how you stop racism. Like, I really don't. Like, I was having a conversation earlier. We was interviewing somebody. It was actually Byron Allen. And Byron Allen was talking about education. He kept talking about education, education, education. Education is the equalizer. And, you know, education can stop racism. And I'm like, no, it can't. Because if you're a racist and a bigot, you don't see my degree on me. You know, you don't know what I majored in. You don't know. All you see is the color of my skin. And, you know, like, you like, all you're going to see is an N-word at the end of the day. So I really don't know what the answer is to that. I don't know how to make white people not be scared of black people. I really don't. I have no idea. I do not know how we can ever look like less of a threat to them. Because the truth of the matter is, they shouldn't be scared of us. Like, when you look at the history of the white man in America, who has been more inherently violent than them? Why are you afraid of us? We should be jumping at y'all, which we do, by the way.
Yeah, that's true.
You know? Yeah. So I really don't know. I don't have the answer to that question at all.
Thank you, Charlamagne.
Thank you. Peace.
Leonard McKelvey, who goes by Charlamagne the God on radio and TV, and his book, Shook One, recently came out in paperback. Natalie Mead is on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and this is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and that's all we've got for today. Please join us next time for a conversation with Philip Pullman, the author of His Dark Materials, which is now on HBO. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Morgan Flannery, Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.